the politics of energy and the environment, meaning energy and how it relates to the environment. I'm John Marty. I'm a state senator from Minnesota who spent a lot of time on energy and utility regulatory committees in the legislature, and a lot of my legislative focus has been on energy policy. And first thing I'd like to suggest is that we don't have an energy policy. Certainly we don't as a nation, and most states don't have anything you can call a real energy policy either. We kind of drift the way the market brings us in various things and pay little attention to what we ought to be looking ahead for. There was some pressures changing that, especially in the early 70s with OPEC driving up oil prices. All of a sudden, people became real concerned about how much energy we were using, and for several years at least, a lot of changes started taking place. Almost every light switch in most public buildings and larger buildings in the country started getting little signs, please turn me off when you leave the room. People started being interested in buying smaller cars. Government took some steps requiring, in Minnesota, they required more energy efficient air conditioners. You couldn't have the really grossly inefficient ones anymore. They put some minimal standards in. Federal government did the same for fuel mileage. So there was, in the early 70s, a big burst of enthusiasm for moving in terms of energy conservation sorts of things. And I'd suggest that lasted until late 70s, and as it slowly tapered off when prices didn't stay up as high as they were, we kind of lost interest in that. Now I think the last 4 or 5 years, there's slowly but surely renewed interest in energy issues. Persian Gulf situation this past year brought a lot of attention to it, and certainly concern about greenhouse gases and the global warming problem, acid rain and other things are making people be aware that not just for price reasons but for environmental reasons, we really ought to look at how we use energy. The main uses of energy in the country are certainly transportation, and we know the problems with our cars, especially people in big cities who live with the smog. Certainly it also has contributions to greenhouse gases and so on through the carbon compounds it puts out. Our second major use is probably electricity, which most of, by far the bulk in the country, is generated by coal and then nuclear power, which have their own problems. Certainly, coal-generated stuff has massive contributions to acid rain and greenhouse gas problems. It even has problems with nuclear radiation because there is trace amounts of uranium and other substances in the coal that we burn to generate electricity. So they do have, we do have emissions of radioactive material as well as other trace metals that are toxic and so on from doing so. There is mercury in coal, lead, other toxics as well. So the amount of coal we use is certainly an environmental concern, plus as well what it's doing to the countryside, and whether it's the open mines or the underground mines, it certainly is causing real problems with, that's a small part of it, but it is an additional consideration. And the other second largest source of power, electric power in the country, is nuclear power, which the industry has been saying for years is perfectly safe, and I'll take them at their word for that because I don't see any reason to argue that. The biggest concern I have about it is the waste. Got a bill passed in the Senate this year, didn't pass in the House yet, but would prohibit our state from giving any more approval, certificate of need, as they have the process in Minnesota, for a new nuclear power plant until the utility wanting to build it can prove that they have a safe place to permanently put the nuclear waste. And that was something that was going to be taken care of long ago. It wasn't going to be a problem. And the federal government was taking it on, and they had this site in Yucca Mountain in Nevada, and Nevada didn't seem to like this idea. And so the federal government is kind of not sure where it's going on it, but we've been using nuclear power for well over 30 years and we still have nothing to do with it. One of Minnesota's two nuclear power plants is now, some people in the industry and people dealing with the issue call them constipation because they have no place to get rid of their waste. They have temporary storage pools to keep the radioactive rods, the spent rods, cool. And they're trying to get permits to expand the storage because they're filling up and there's no place to get rid of them. They move it to other temporary storage and so on. The reason I have concern about the long-term disposal is we're not, when government looks long-term, I think we can be pleased that we're looking 10 years down the road. And certainly some things we're beginning to recognize we should be looking 50 and 100 years down the road. And maybe government is making some slight progress in some areas that way. But with nuclear waste, we're not looking at 10 years or 100 years, we're looking at 10,000 years. And if you want to figure out what the world is going to be like 10,000 years from now, think back 10,000 years, it's 8,000 BC. I mean, that's pre-hieroglyphics. We don't picture all the changes that have happened in the last 10,000 years. Whatever we generate with this, we have to figure out what we're going to do with it for 10,000 years to make it relatively safe. And I don't think we have the foggiest idea what we're going to do with it in the end. And so I guess the biggest concern I have about nuclear power environmentally is the waste problem. Plus, when you do shut down the reactors, it's basically a wasted place. You just permanently encapsulate it. And the cost of that, more and more states are beginning to require the utilities to prepare for that so we don't leave that to our kids' generation to foot the bill for our electric costs. But those are the two main sources of our electric power. Obviously, Holden isn't a good example of, it's not a microcosm of the country's electric use because here in the summer, everybody, why bother to worry about the electric consumption because they can generate far more very cheaply than is used. Though in the winter they have shortages here too because the water flow isn't very much. But Holden Village isn't the place we ought to go for an example of how we ought to work towards conserving electricity. I was in the dining hall last night about 11:30 and nobody else, everybody else, every other night when I've come in there, I've seen it empty at times and all of the lights on in there. It's not a real big deal here because of the way it's generated, but it's a terrible example for us to bring home to where we live and other places. Anyway, the third major use of energy we have is heating and cooling. Generally heating because a lot of our cooling is done through electric power, through home air conditioners and so on. But the heating, we generally use coal, which we've talked about the problems of before, fuel oil and a lot of other fossil fuels, which certainly contribute to the global warming problem. So all of those types of, all of our energy uses, the way we use them right now have some serious impacts on the environment. I'd argue that we have two reasons for making changes in that. First of all is to protect the environment, and the second of all is the economics of it. As a nation that gets a whole lot of its resources, its energy resources from foreign sources, the cost of doing that is a real burden on our economy, and for that matter, the natural gas we dig out here, the coal we get out here, the oil we can get here, we've gotten much of the easy stuff out of the ground. It's getting harder and harder to do it, and so the costs of that go up. And I would suggest that the one-time investment in conservation is a good way to not only reduce the environmental damages, but also to work for better economic savings in terms of make a one-time investment that may over 10, 20-year periods pay us back several times over and reduce fuel costs. But I would argue that what we need in an energy policy, which we don't have right now, is first of all conservation and energy efficiency. And number two, a move to clean renewable sources of fuel. nobody has all the answers to all this sort of thing, exactly how we're going to do it. I think we can project that for cars 50 years from now, we can't really continue for environmental reasons alone burning gasoline in the cars. But what are we going to do? Battery-powered electric cars? We don't have great batteries that'll take care of that kind of thing, long enough charge. Are we going to, perhaps the smart way to do it, it might turn out to be hydrogen-powered cars where we use electricity to generate hydrogen, compress the hydrogen, put it in little tanks, and you burn hydrogen, you come up with water. So how we're going to get to all these things is not always entirely clear, but I would suggest that both the move to clean renewable sources of fuel and conservation energy efficiency are the two moves that we have to make as a policy. When we talk about conservation, most people think about what we were told to do in the early 70s. Turn out the lights when you leave the room. Certainly a lot of offices, our state capitol complex, a whole lot of fluorescent lights have little red dots on them, and those lights don't work. And what was that? Well, the bulbs work fine. They just disconnected those lights in the early 70s when they decided the rooms were brighter than they needed to be for their purpose. And that certainly saves some energy. President Carter in the late 70s, when he had his talk on energy and so on, he wear a cardigan sweater and sit by a fireside and turn down the heat kind of thing. And certainly conservation does entail reducing our use through avoiding waste that way. But I'd argue the other thing that we do very little of is more energy efficiency standards. How many of you know what a compact fluorescent light looks like? How many of you have any of them in your house?
I have two light bulbs, but they don't fit any of my lights.
They don't fit any of them. The kind that have the couple of tubes or something like that?
No, they're just too long. They're not real long.
Yeah, they're too long to fit in the fixtures. We have that problem with
$25 bulbs.
Or more.
We found some in Minnesota recently for $10, but most of the building supply stores don't even carry them. They did several years ago, and they didn't see a big market for them. Anyway, the compact fluorescent bulbs screw into regular incandescent socket, and they're self-starting things with the ballast the way they are. I don't know exactly how a fluorescent light works, but they screw in real nicely and work fine if they fit. And a typical compact fluorescent is 18 watts, and they claim to be as bright as a 75-watt incandescent bulb. I'm not quite sure that it's quite that much illumination. It seems more like a 60-watt bulb to me, but I think they exaggerate that a little bit. But nevertheless, even if it's 60, it's 3-to-1 energy savings, plus the length of the bulb. If you pay 50 cents a bulb and can get them cheaper than that, you can get them twice that much. But if you're paying 50 cents a bulb, during the course of the fluorescent light, you'll have bought so many, almost as many bulbs of the other kind to pay for better than half the cost of the one you use for the fluorescent, plus the energy savings. I'm told that if for a $15 bulb, and again, I've seen between $10 and $20 in our state.
But this is no small thing. I thought that the electrical savings would be just a small patch kind of thing. But Jennings on ABC News did a graph, and they were talking about going to the wilderness, the last pool of oil up there.
In Alaska, yeah.
Oil, and they compared how much they'd get out of that to just going to fluorescent bulbs, for instance, and you save twice as much energy. No, not twice, but about 10 or more times. But if we could switch to more,
if we use a lot more fluorescent lights, yeah,
then there is totally in that pool of oil.
In a typical, if you buy a $15 one of those bulbs, and you burn it an average number of hours per day. The bulb lasts about 10 years with, I don't know what it is, 5 hours a day burning or something. And the amount of electricity you use in that time, if you had a 60-watt incandescent bulb instead of that 18-watt thing, the total cost to you is going to be more like buying that bulb and paying for the electricity to operate it is going to be about $50 less over that 10-year period than buying the regular incandescent bulbs and replacing them when they burn out and paying the electricity, the light with them. It's tremendous savings. I carried a bill this year, a little trivial bill. When I was first told about it, I kind of thought the guy was fooling me. But Isaac Walton Lee came to me and said, little exit signs, which in Minnesota have to be illuminated in public buildings, electric fluorescent light signs. He said that they were incandescent bulbs, and you can buy these little conversion kits for $15, and they save about $12 to $15 a year in electricity. So it pays for itself in 1 year. It uses 10 watts instead of 40 watts, which the typical ones have now, 220-watt bulbs in them. And I said, well, yeah, but most of them are fluorescent already, because they're nice thin ones in our Capitol building. I said, look, out there. And he said, no, those are incandescent. I said, no, I'm sure they're not. He said, take off the cover and check. We took off the cover, and it was little thin incandescent bulbs. He knew exactly what he was talking about. I looked at their numbers. They estimated Minnesota has probably about 2 million exit signs. We made the estimate of 1 million and figured it was going to save, we saved the power from a 70 megawatt generator, which is a fairly sizable, it's not a massive one. I mean, the biggest ones we build now are dozens of times that large, but still a significant amount of power, and they figured the cost savings, again, for every one of those bulbs would be about $13 worth of electricity less used per year, times 1 to 2 million bulbs. That's a lot of electricity saved. And again, the payback for the fixture is the first year, practically. Why don't people use it? Well, partly lack of understanding. That's the way every building supplier has been given things in the past. New building costs are, the economy doesn't always, market forces don't always work quite right in something like this. If I'm building a new building, I'm not likely to be the occupier of that new office building. I lease space in it, and generally the electric costs, the utility costs are paid by the people moving into the building. And if it saves me $15 to put in the fixture this way and they're responsible for replacing the bulbs, if there are hundreds of these signs in a typical office building, it's a lot of money. You go the cheaper route, and people paying the bills don't realize there's the option available. But we passed a little tiny bill this year that mandates that beginning, I think, 2 years from now, you can't sell or install new bulbs in exit signs that are incandescent. And that one little thing, and it was, I saw it more as symbolic value, but still saving literally millions of bucks a year. And certainly every kind of energy efficiency that way. Several years ago, the U.S. Congress put in one for energy efficiency appliances. And it would have preempted the states from doing anything further than it, because the manufacturers all, they don't want to be able to sell this kind of refrigerator in this state, but you can't sell it in that state. Different standards in every state. So they were saying, yeah, they found the federal standards acceptable. Passed Congress almost unanimously, I think this was about 86, and Reagan vetoed it to everyone's surprise. So what Audubon Society did, they came to legislators in about 45 states, I carried the bill in our state, to put in tougher standards in our own state. And then, of course, the industry was real alarmed at the prospect of all these standards, so they came back and lobbied hard, and the president signed it the next time around. But one thing like that can eliminate the need for dozens of new power plants. And we need to mandate it. You and I might, as individual consumers, decide, if we have the information available, we might decide to go buy the more efficient refrigerator. It may cost an extra $100 and save us 3 times that in electricity over the life of the refrigerator. We may choose to do that. We may figure, well, we're really tight on money. We can't afford the more expensive one now, so we'll buy the cheaper one. But the problem is a whole lot of, I mean, in Minnesota, 30% or so of the housing is rental housing. When you provide rental housing, you don't buy the most efficient stuff. If you're tenants are paying the rent, the utilities. So you buy less efficient ones, plus there's the lack of knowledge about the savings available. So our utilities and lots of them in other states actually give people rebates for buying the most efficient ones, which would make sense economically even without the rebates. But energy efficiency is a major, major consideration. Yes?
What's the flip side or the motivation for not having, not mandating the more efficient appliances?
Cost more initially. The initial cost is higher. Manufacturers tend to be reluctant to have standards in place. Minnesota, again, as I said 15 years ago, put in a requirement for more efficient air conditioners, and at that time, it's long before I got involved in the political process, but the air conditioner manufacturers, I don't know, the energy efficiency ratio, as they call it, for window air conditioners and so on, they banned anything under, I don't know what, 6.5 or something, and some of them you could buy down to 4-point-something efficiency. And I think a lot of environmentalists wanted to have it more like 7.5 or something. Industry fought the whole standard, and the compromise was there. Basically, well, why, hey, let the market play its role, and if we want to sell less efficient ones, we should be able to do that. And some people saying, look, if I want to buy a cheaper air conditioner, I should be allowed to, not realizing that the true cost of the thing includes the power you're using to supply it. And unless you're at a place like Holden Village, you're going to be paying through the teeth for the electricity on the one that may be half as efficient. But basically, there's reluctance. Status quo is acceptable to people making a product or selling it, not always, but we have some, in terms of weatherization standards, we've got a number of builders, home builders in Minnesota who kind of want some tougher standards. It's not universally wanted, but some of the ones who build more energy efficient homes anyway, they feel they don't get the extra value of their home because others can compete against them with shoddier construction and lesser insulation standards. They don't mind tougher standards. Because they feel they're being competed against unfairly by people who are selling inferior products. So they just as soon like it, but most of the home manufacturers, I think, are reluctant to because, hey, we can sell a cheaper product this way. They're not paying attention to the long-term costs. And the social costs we all pay through the environmental effects. But certainly, it still is kind of, I guess I'd suggest that the well-designed housing for both natural lighting and natural heating and cooling, better insulation and so on, is still more almost experimental. It's more, doesn't have to be, but most new homes built, I would argue, are not as efficient as they should be for the climate they're in. Yes?
Of course, it's not surprising that the other side of the coin is that most people who are complaining about new housing today are complaining that it's unaffordable already. And if you impose new standards now, you're obviously going to reduce the new market even further than it's already been reduced.
You can, if you're looking at it simply that way, but if you count
it,
well, except for the fact that most people have to figure out in their bills over the next 15 years what their utility bills are.
That's
their taxes.
What the lenders look at.
Well,
the lenders
taxes.
Say, if you can afford this much a month, then that buys you a house at this price.
I understand. They're also, lenders do try and take into account, I'm not going to say everyone does, but they try and take into account what a tax burden is going to be. They try and take into account what somebody's going to have available, what kind of income they're going to have disposable for that. And I'm not in the banking business and don't know exactly how well they do at taking those things into account. But those are certainly, I mean, that's one of the systems where the economics of it doesn't always follow as efficiently as it could. Because if I'm going to buy a house that's going to cut my energy bills by $50 a month, that should give me $50 a month to pay for a higher housing price, especially if the higher housing price is $15 a month. And I'm not going to argue that every lender does that, and you're probably right that they don't fully take that into account, but they do try and take into account taxes and so on. And
they usually try to just keep it simple, I think.
Yeah, okay.
It's
well,
complex enough usually.
Yeah. And it's not always how many kids you have and how many other things are certainly big burdens in what you can afford. And the other concern is if you have shoddy people, shoddy construction of super insulated housing, if you don't have, you're going to have environmental problems inside the home. I think many people don't realize all of the environmental hazards internal to their home. And if you seal the house, put a balloon around the house, you're going to have potential for real problems, both from formaldehyde and pressed wood. People who use any kind of aerosol sprays contribute to it. Smoke from either cooking or cigarettes or whatever. All those things are trapped in the house, and moisture being one of them. When we replaced our furnace several years ago, we got a high efficiency one that also takes its air intake from outside the house. Because our house is relatively well sealed, not as tight as it could be because we were concerned about it. One winter we tried to see how tight we could get it, and we noticed quickly you can get water moisture problems. The air gets too humid. Most houses, most people have in cold weather have problems with their houses being way too dry. We knew our house was getting pretty tight when we started getting the air much more humid. And we loosened it up a bit because of the air quality concerns. And they do have air-to-air heat exchangers that allow you to have much more frequent air transfer. But you have to do it right, and that isn't cheap. What I'd argue is the cost is far cheaper than failing to make the conservation investment in the first place. Certainly in terms of auto efficiency standards, I think we all recognize, I know my parents were, in 1970, they were driving a station wagon that got 13 miles to the gallon or so, and they replaced it with two smaller cars. We could take the family in both cars together and use less fuel than the one big car. And that's not exactly a dollar for dollar thing, because two small cars is more expensive than one large one. But when people are very seldom driving with a full car load of stuff, we learned back in the 70s to make more efficient use of cars. And the care that needs to be made in making cars safe as they make them more efficient. Because smaller cars, if they're not designed right, can be much more dangerous in terms of head-on collisions. So there are all those trade-offs to consider, but I would argue that we're now learning how to make cars much more efficient, and that's a wise investment for us as a society to push towards. Again, the conservation method of reducing, not the energy efficiency one for transportation, is using more mass transit, which is something we've too often ignored, and driving less, whether using bicycle or some other alternative. Those kind of things, I think, have to work hand in hand in terms of doing that. There are estimates that the energy efficiency improvements we could make cost effectively in this country are about 50%. In other words, we waste half of the energy through lack of efficiency in lighting, appliances, and so on. That's not counting the improvements we can make by using less. Again, most people, when they talk about using less energy, they talk about, well, I'm going to turn my thermostat down even lower in the winter, I'm already cold. The 50% estimates, and those are the best that people estimate we could do, would be if we were not counting those, but simply counting the more efficient use of electricity and other energy. But that's what they figure is the maximum we could get at an economically affordable rate. You could make greater energy savings than that, but the cost per kilowatt hour or BTU or however you're going to measure it would exceed the cost of purchasing power. But right now, the cheapest way we can get additional energy availability is through conservation. I think in almost every setting that's the case. Now to the second issue, the renewable sources of energy. I think I talked a little bit earlier about some of the problems with coal and nuclear and automobile fuels. Nuclear fusion should be safe. The end product is safe. I believe it's hydrogen when you combine it. and that's perfectly safe gas, there's no reason we couldn't get that to work if someday nuclear fusion pans out. We don't know if it's going to ever, however. I'd suggest the ones that are much closer to use are our generation of electricity through wind and potentially solar power. In Minnesota, I carried legislation that did pass this year that will suggest that any new power plants in Minnesota that are constructed, in order to get a permit to build one of those, the utility has to show the regulatory agency not only that they looked at all forms of renewable, or they looked at various forms of renewable energy, but also that the source they chose, if they didn't choose one of those, was cheaper, and the important words were including environmental costs. Right now, coal is, I will guess, about 2 cents per kilowatt hour cheaper than wind power on the southwestern ridge in Minnesota that's got high wind speed. That's the most promising area for wind power in Minnesota. The cost per kilowatt hour is about 2 cents a kilowatt hour cheaper. And I've seen various estimates that say it may not be quite that much more, but it's an estimate that I've seen most of them come around 2 cents a kilowatt hour. And so it is cheaper to build a coal-fired plant unless you factor in the environmental costs. If you factor in the costs from acid rain, which does require people to paint their houses more often, and the damage we have to lakes and so on that we have to correct, and all the other costs of environmental costs, which are measurable. It's not an exact science, but other states have done this already. Minnesota is not the first to try this. A number of states have required factoring of environmental costs, and you do it through a hearing process so both sides can make their arguments and probably compromise somewhere in the middle in terms of what those environmental costs are. But if you factor those in, I'm going to make the suggestion that I think in Minnesota right now, any new power plants are likely to be, because of that legislation, wind powered right now. I would also suggest the most promising long-term potential power supply is going to be solar power. But right now the cost per kilowatt hour, which is falling every year as we get further along with it, it's still not close to competitive, except in a few remote areas, a lot of Forest Service stations or Minnesota State Parks, where you'd have to run new power lines in for umpteen miles for a small supply of it. They find out by making a small solar panel system, they can generate their own electricity there cheaper than they would by bringing in the power. But that's not a typical setting, and in terms of power use in this country, it's not even a decent fraction of a percent. It's almost experimental or pilot project kind of status again. And most people trying to, if we were trying to build a solar collector to generate electricity right now, you couldn't build it anywhere near competitively with what you can purchase the electricity from. But I would argue the same thing would have been true with nuclear power if we didn't have the federal investment, both the Manhattan Project and along the years, the investments our federal government has made into nuclear power research has been...
Is there anything that you're aware of, John, in terms of research and development at the federal
level? At the federal level, not right now.
That moves in those other directions? Or?
Not right now. I think there's...
At one time when Carter was president, we funded research, though. But
we did a little bit, right. We had a little bit of funding, but not much. I mean, nothing near the scope of what we did for nuclear power. And will we do that in the next few years? I don't know. I guess I'd argue it would be a great thing to do, because the amount of research being done right now is a token amount, in effect, compared to the potential payoff from it. But I would argue that's the most likely long-term promising one. The wind, from the measurements I've seen, this one, by putting wind farms in certain areas in southwestern Minnesota, we could more than supply our entire state's energy needs.
Two parts. One is, have you heard anything whether scrubbers are efficient for coal? And then the other one is how realistic is alcohol?
Okay. In terms of coal scrubbers and so on, to clean the emissions from coal, they're certainly efficient. I mean, any new power plant built has them in there. And that's one of the factors you count in with the coal plant. We don't burn any new power plant. Probably any state in the country doesn't just shoot the exhaust up without doing anything to catch as much of the emissions as they can. Though the more efficient they are at catching the emissions, the more expensive they are. So basically any new power plant does have at least a minimal amount of that. The acid rain controls, Minnesota, among other states, have already done a lot more than other states have. And so the issue with the federal government in terms of acid rain controls is who's paying the cost for the other states that don't have them? Should everybody share equally, or should those who have not made the investments themselves have to pay a heavier percentage of it? And they've been fighting about significant changes in acid rain policy at the federal government for years, and the administration seems to think we need more research on it, and others think we've been waiting far too long to act. But yes, coal plants, any new ones built, do have some amount of it in. The question is how much of these cleaning systems they have, and even so, the wind isn't dirty. Yeah, it's what's left over that's the problem, including the ash and so on. What's left over in the air and in the ash is a problem, and it's more than you can get from the wind, which obviously doesn't pollute at all. It's just blowing by with or without the turbines. You had a question for?
Alcohol.
Oh, alcohol. I'm sorry. Alcohol is being used in a number of ways. Ethanol in terms of cars and so on. I've heard all kinds of contradictory things over the years about whether it is takes more energy to produce a gallon of ethanol than it supplies. I'm told that's not the case. That originally it was, the initial plants were, because they were very inefficient. And then I hear people arguing that for world hunger reasons we can't afford to use corn for that. I'd argue that that's not, as one who's very concerned about world hunger, the problem in the world isn't really a lack of grain right now. Matter of fact, well, same reason we're paying farmers not to produce in many cases. India has a surplus of grain. I mean, they have massive surplus of grain in India. The problem with that is poverty. People can't afford to buy the grain. I mean, people in India, it's a serious problem there. But I would suggest that we do have enough grain, and we can certainly produce enough of various types of grains to generate the ethanol or various forms of alcohol fuels. The question is that the best way to go in terms of major amounts? Because it still does, first of all, we use a lot of petroleum products to produce the energy that comes from various forms of grain alcohol.
Well, Brazil was on 100% alcohol for their cars.
Brazil?
Yeah. I might be wrong, but I thought...
Yeah, you may be. I don't know exactly how they're doing it. It tends to be the oxygenation. I mean, we want to have, if we have a 10% alcohol type of blend in a fuel, it does tend to clean up some of our air quality problems with more complete burning. From the oxygen, you get less carbon monoxide.
What about garbage? Weren't they trying to do something with garbage?
They do burn. Minnesota burns more than most states in terms of burning garbage. Just the energy needs of the country we generate a lot of garbage, but in terms of the amount of electricity, the amount of power we need, it's a small fraction of it. And it's basically a new small form of power supply we have as well. I would suggest that I mean, we shouldn't be trying to find more garbage to burn because of the emissions from problems with that. But having said that, we got to recognize that we are going to have some energy generated from that. I think more and more states, Minnesota this year passed a thing requiring, I don't know, 2 years down the road or so, that all fuel is going to have some oxygenated supply of fuel in it too, which is going to be some kind of probably ethanol. And that, for air quality reasons, will help. It's not going to be a major savings over the cost of pure gasoline, And if it's 10% of the fuel, it's making only a 10% cut in our gasoline consumption. So it's a small part of the thing, again, I'd argue.
Yeah, a huge section of our energy consumption, petroleum consumption, that doesn't usually get thrown into this discussion, I think, is used in food production. I mean, when you consider all the fertilizers that are produced, delivered, applied, all the farming equipment that's used, all the putting the food together, taking it to market back and forth, slaughtering animals, producing taking water out of say the Columbia River, mm-hmm. reducing the amount of water to irrigate and to feed animals. When you're talking about that, you're talking about not a small hunk, but like almost the major hunk of our energy use. And animal production is about 16 times more energy intensive than vegetable production. And there's not that we can become in any short period of time a vegetarian nation, but if we were to become a vegetarian nation, energy issues would essentially disappear. They would become incredibly manageable. That would take most of the energy issues away, and people need to explore that, because it's almost an unheard of idea.
I will agree with everything you're saying, except for the fact that in terms of what percentage of our energy use is going into agriculture stuff. I'll agree with you that animals and things higher up the food chain are much more energy consuming, and therefore they require more land as well. It's a much less efficient way to get our nutrition.
Well, there's a lot of land in the Dakotas and Montana, Wyoming.
That you can't do anything but that.
Anything, yeah.
But in terms of a lot of Minnesota farmland and Iowa and so on, for hog production and so on, land that could well be used for other thing other than feed grain.
Could be health fallow.
And again, the energy used, as you mentioned, to fertilize and run the machinery to harvest that, it definitely does use a lot. I don't accept the numbers that's going to take care of our energy problems, but I think you're right. We can certainly, one way that we save energy and other resources, protecting the environment, is by more efficient use of our food supply, and that is lower down the food chain, which Holden Village does a major effort to do. And you can tell, especially from some of the kids grumbling, but I've heard adults grumbling too, that not everybody sees that as their kind of thing. But it is... you're right. I mean, Americans, for their own health, eat a lot more higher up the food chain things than is good for us.
The energy numbers are mammoth. They're not small at all. You know, it takes about 2,500 gallons of water to produce a hamburger. You can do everything that you can for a month in your family. Reduce your energy consumption by baths, watering your lawns, washing your car. You know, really cut down to what you really would consider the bare basis. You go to McDonald's and have a hamburger, and there it went. You could have saved all that water by not having one hamburger. I mean, the environmental issues are huge.
Al Pitcher was the village scholar for 20 months here, and he wrote a lot of different essays. And they just recently printed up 300 of Why I Choose Not to Eat Meat. Mm-hmm. And he quit eating meat while he was here, and it's over many things like that. And so we got a stack of them. When you leave here, you go into the resource center room on the table right there, and then I'll just like to point out that there's a whole metal shelf there that's all related to environmental matters.
Okay.
There's a lot of things on energy there.
Everybody knows where the resource center is, just down the hall to the left.
Has any research ever been applied towards harnessing tidal energy? I know I've seen you know, conceptual plans of how you could use tidal energy to run turbines and that type of thing. Has there ever been anything researched?
Maybe somebody else can say. The only thing I've heard is the conceptual drawings about how you could conceivably do that, and same as a lot of geothermal energy types of things. I mean, there's a lot of sources of energy in the world that if somebody can figure out a way to harness them in a relatively quick way. My argument would be the two with the most promise are going to be wind, which I think is already here, and solar, which is close. But I don't know, maybe somebody else knows more about that.
You know, tidal energy has been used both by the French for one installation, and I think it installed something some years ago that they have funded, which is off, I think, Fitzgerald Island, Nova Scotia, up in Canada, which has the largest...
The highest tides, you know, yeah.
A couple comments on things I've heard. The Brazilians use a lot of ethanol, which is produced from excess sugar cane, primarily a function of their deforestation of the Amazon River Basin. Any energy that man produces, I don't care what it is, I'm an engineer, mm-hmm. I'm in the energy business, we have to make trade-offs all the time, has a price. Vast solar arrays that would cross our deserts would change our energy patterns. There's discussion that very large wind farms could change local weather patterns. There are statistics that would indicate that the large amount of irrigation that's taken place in eastern Washington and spreading water over a vast desert has changed the weather over there in the last 40 years. I grew up over there, and I think I can attest to what I think I've seen change over the last 30 or 40 years. There are no good solutions. Probably the worst thing that has happened to the earth is agriculture. We've devastated flora and fauna to feed ourselves. And whether we feed ourselves with vegetables or feed ourselves with beef, we are doing it to ourselves. And the trade-offs are difficult ones to make. In the engineering business, in the energy business, and actually our company now is in the environmental business, we've done some work for the government on new energy technologies. One is magnetohydrothermodynamics, which is a fascinating technology. It came up in the Red October thing, if you haven't seen that movie. It was kind of a silly movie, but nevertheless, the technology is there. The DOE is putting a little bit of money into fusion research, which is going to produce radioactive waste, is going to, the high neutron levels that are produced by that technology creates very large amounts of waste shield material and so on that's going to have to be disposed of. There are no panaceas. There are no easy answers.
If
there is a problem, mm-hmm. it's population. If there is a problem, and there's not much that we're willing to do about that. Look what Holden has done to Copper Creek. We have destroyed Copper Creek to the fishery by installing a hydro plant.
In terms of hydro, which I did not bring up because I guess I basically think that much of the hydro potential in the country is used in anything additional. There's a proposal up in Canada would involve flooding massive land areas and environmentally sensitive ones. Somewhere in the Holden Library, I was looking through a book the other day from mid-60s, and it was showing the dedication of the Glen Canyon Dam and Lake Powell and mid-60s, and what a wonderful thing this was and all the power it was going to produce and so on. Well, and what a wonderful recreation area this was. Well, probably elsewhere in the library there's the book by the Elliot Porter or some of the other photographers showing how beautiful Glen Canyon Dam was. Some people thought more than the Grand Canyon, and it's gone. But I would argue in terms of environmental consequences, if we ever did put large panels of solar power, I don't picture, maybe they would be all in one desert area or something, and I can picture that do having an impact on the climate around there, and we have to have some concerns. The biggest problem we have, though, is the use of fossil fuels. We're generating so much more heat than we're generating it a lot quicker right now than anywhere in past human history, because we're taking out stuff that happened then. Trees generate, when they die and rot away, they're generating greenhouse gases. Granted, but it should be a life cycle of a tree from seedling to ash, to the tree's death and rotting away, should consume the same amount of carbon dioxide. I mean, it's a fixed amount of it, but now that there's so much buried in the world, and we're digging it out in fossil fuels and burning it all at once, that's what's causing the problem. And I can't see, I mean, you've got a fixed amount of solar energy coming down on us, and if we're using it, generating it one way, which also produces the heat, I guess I don't buy it that it's an equal kind of trade-off to some of the massive consumption of the fossil fuels. We do have to be concerned about the local climate there. I don't think we're at the stage where we're talking about putting in enough solar panels to talk about whether we put them all in one place or we put them all over the place. But in terms of what we're doing, I suggest that some of those are a lot less. I mean, granted, if we put too many wind things there, it will change it because it's using the wind energy and converting it to something else, so it's slowing down the wind, in effect.
But just a little smidgen of it. I'm no brain or anything, but just the exposure of the term chaos. There's a science of chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And just that fact tells me that we don't know what the effect of this over here will have on this over here. And so not knowing that, everything is going to be trade-off, and I just wonder where the hope is.
No, I guess I think in terms of hopes, when I heard Glenn Mogelson's talk last week, and when he was talking about risks of various power supply, and he said, well, yeah, everything has some trade-offs and so on, but some of them are more severe. Some of them are good trade-offs. Some of them are bad trade-offs. I guess the choice is making ones that have relatively good trade-offs. When we talk about the compact fluorescent tubes, I mean, they do have, I'm told they recycle fluorescent tubes in Europe in some places. Fluorescent tubes do have mercury in them, and they need the mercury, and it's a small amount, but it adds up if you're getting a lot of fluorescent tubes. So it's not like it's a simple, like everything is a simple answer, but I think some of them are clearly better payoff types of things and lower risks than other ones. And what the trick is to do is pick the ones with the lowest risk. And I would argue that the solar and wind power ones are much, much less risk than the digging up of fossil fuels and trying to do it that way, because the greenhouse gas problem, I think, is enough concern. We don't know enough about the long-term climate effects or how great it is, but there is some evidence that it's...
Yeah, I basically agree with you. I think our use of fossil fuels, the way we've done it, is a tragedy. I mean, particularly for fuels. I mean, we've been given an enormously complex building material by nature for whatever purpose we can use it for, and we simply are burning.
Yeah.
And what a waste.
Natural gas.
You can make medicines out of it. You can make plastics out of them. Maybe you don't like plastics, but I think plastics are better than smelting steel because the environmental impacts are probably less than making it. But it's an enormous waste to burn up these 10 and 12 and 15 chain hydrocarbons that are there for the use, for our use, and we're doing nothing but destroying them.
Just burning them recklessly without paying attention to how it. We have about 2 more minutes. Any other questions or comments?
One was that I don't know how politically we could encourage people to make a bill that says you got to be vegetarian. you got to cut down on your population. Another thing is natural gas. I don't know if it's the natural gas company or whatever, but I saw a very flowery thing about how wonderful it would be if we all converted our cars to natural gas.
In terms of environmental impact in the short term, it's a lot better, it's a whole lot better to burn natural gas than it is to burn gasoline. Oh, very, very clean for a fossil fuel. However, we do have lots of it, but it depends how fast we use up lots of it in our transportation system. I would argue short term, we ought to be switching, like our diesel buses might be better off switched to that. The clean fuels, especially in areas where we have big populations in cities and so on. Natural gas is not an unlimited resource, but we do have a lot of it. the harder to get stuff is, more environmental consequences to get it out. But it is a cleaner burning fuel. The thing that bothers me is utility companies in Minnesota, the natural gas company was trying to bring back gas lighting. We banned it in the energy crisis years. I'm told that the cost of typical good, modern, efficient gas light, the kind that dims itself at day and gets brighter at night, so it just minimal use during the daytime, still uses like $90 to $150 worth of natural gas a year. Conversion from one of those old gas lamps, our front yard has an old gas lamp in that's been shut off for 15 years or whatever. If we wanted to convert that to electric lighting, we could have a brighter light for that we could burn every night for a fraction of the cost, 10, 15 bucks, pay for itself in 2-3 years of conversion. Our gas company was trying to get us to go back to natural gas lighting. At the same time, our electric company is trying to encourage people to heat with electricity. Holden Village can do it because of its heating supply. They, because of the system, our pricing system, utilities want to sell more power. Can't blame them for wanting that. I keep clipping ads on this kind of thing, a utility in northern Minnesota. A tree lighting contest for Christmas trees, or Christmas lighting contest. Keep your lights on longer after Christmas now so your neighbors can see them more. Even though the judging's complete, let your neighbors all enjoy this. Electric company does that. Our largest county, where Minneapolis is, their government center, the energy company was proposing to give them free of charge outdoor lighting to light up this beautiful building. The cost of the lights were, $80,000, $100,000 to put in these massive floodlights. They would give them to them free. Why? Well, they're paying the electric bills on it then. I'd argue that's the kind of, I don't take for granted every word that the utility companies are saying is in our best interest. However, I will agree with them that we'd have a lot cleaner air if we would switch our cars to natural gas. As you were mentioning, natural gas is one of those most valuable fossil fuels, and for us to be just burning it up recklessly is concerns me. Though.
I was just wondering how many homeowners have requested free energy audits. You know, in most areas, you can get a they'll come out to your house and whatever your major heating source is, they'll do a free energy audit and they'll tell you, you know, what to do. And in a lot of places, they're going to give you things. In a lot of states, there's a $400 to $2,000 grants that all you have to do is sign on the dotted line, and then they'll come out and they'll install the extra insulation. Thanks. And as far as buying a compact fluorescence for your house, I mean, what other investments do you know of that if you invest a dollar, you're going to get back three or get back two? That's the kind of investment you're talking about. If you go through your house and replace with compact fluorescent lights, you know, if you spend $600, you're going to get back.
The biggest trouble is people think if I came to you and told you, here, you want to buy this light bulb, it's going to cost you only 10 bucks and it's going to save you three times what it costs you, and it's a wonderful idea and we ought to all do it, you'd think I was stretching the truth. It's too good to be true in some cases. Sounds that way, and that's the way this fluorescent exit sign built.
Well,
sounded
the old-fashioned fluorescent light is efficient too.
It's efficient too. Yes. The only reason for this is most people don't have 4-foot or 8-foot sockets like these. They're with the ballast and everything in them.
It's not too attractive for most houses.
No. So, and there also is quality of lighting kinds of things. What color of lighting you want? But that's a good point about the energy audits. Minnesota, I think most of our utilities have $10 for an energy audit, which is subsidized by the utility at the state's requirement.
John, I'm going to say this, and I can't support it right now, but I sat down as an engineer and I ran out the calculations to replace a fluorescent bulb in my home using the stated light on the carton of a fluorescent bulb versus the stated light of an incandescent bulb that I can buy at a discount store for 30, 40 cents a piece, and at 3.5, 4.5 cents a kilowatt hour, which is what we're paying in Seattle. I couldn't justify putting in a $20 bulb. I couldn't.
I did the cost estimate on ours and it paid off real big.
You're paying what?